The biggest stories.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story.
The big opinions.
Blah, blah, blah. Yada, yada, yada.
Each and every week.
That would be great.
This is the Intersection Podcast with Jason Page.
Fantastic.
Here's Jason.
Thank you, Chad Erickson, and welcome to the latest episode of the Intersection Podcast. This week, we're talking sports and politics with my man, Stan Van Gundy. He's the head coach of the New Orleans Pelicans. He's one of my very favorite guys in the entire sports world. We worked together back in the day with NBC Sports, and we've stayed in touch ever since. I want to ask Stan for a deeper look inside the game of the great Zion Williamson, this burgeoning star. We'll chat about the future of this Pelicans team as well. And I also want to talk to him about his activity on social media and some of his political stances as well, which garner a lot of attention. So let's get it started.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we present to you the Intersection Interview.
All right, talking with former Heat, Magic, and Pistons head coach, now the head coach of the New Orleans Pelicans. He is Stan Van Gundy. Stan, you're becoming the Octavio Dotel of NBA coaches here.
I don't know about that now. There's a lot of guys who've been around more than I have, but
we
have bounced a little bit.
It's actually funny you were saying that, because I'm trying to think of how many guys have been head coaches in the league four times. There isn't that many that have actually been head coaches in the league four times.
Not that many. I know the guy I succeeded, Alvin Gentry, you know. I haven't really thought about it. You're right, not a lot, probably.
not a lot. I'm like, and to me, now a lot of people will say, some people will look at that as, you know, glass half full, glass half empty, and there will be the cynics who will say, well, God, he's getting, you know, four different times he got hired. That means three different times he got fired. But then I'll look at it and say, you're not a spring chicken. You're not a young guy. In a day and age where the trend is younger head coaches, go get that young genius. For you to get hired a fourth time as a head coach, and again, you're in your 60s. You don't need me to tell you. You're in your 60s. To me, it says the league has an immense amount of respect for this guy.
Well, that's nice of you to say. A lot nicer than you reminding me of how old I am. That is nice of you to say, but I'm not sure there is a trend one way or another. I mean, Doc Rivers, you know, hired again in Philly this year, certainly not young. Steve Clifford, not real young. Billy Donovan, far from a young guy, getting another chance. So I don't know. I mean, there's both. I just think the hiring of coaches is, first of all, it's a very hard thing to do, I think, for people. So you see people go on all different directions with it. So there's a lot of us old dudes in the league right now that have been around a long time. And now, you know, Nate McMillan back at it in Atlanta. There's a lot of us there with a lot of experience now. New York didn't go with a young guy. They went with Tom Thibodeau. You know, I mean, I don't know if there's even a trend, but if there is, it might actually be skewing older a little bit right now.
Yeah, these things are always cyclical. You know, they always sort of bounce back and forth. So that wouldn't shock me if that was the case. Talk to me a little bit about, for a second, the start and what a lot of people will say, well, if I don't start with Zion Williamson. Selected to his first All-Star team in his second season in the league. And I'll ask you about the All-Star game here in a second. But how do you feel watching him from afar last year in his rookie season? Give me something about him. Give me something. You know, we all watch him on TV and you know, what he's doing at the age of 20. And he's not going to be 21 until July. Try and give me something that being around him on a day-in, day-out basis, and I'm just talking about during the 48 minutes of an NBA game, but, you know, the practice, what little practice time you get, the locker room. Give me something we don't see that impresses you just as much as what we're seeing on the court.
Well, you know, when I had first gotten the job, Jason, Coach K was gracious enough to spend a long time with me on the phone talking about Zion and Brandon Ingram. And one of the things that probably the most prominent thing he kept saying and coming back to about Zion was how smart he was. This guy's really smart. And then he would talk about some other things and he'd come back. He'd say, Stan, I'm telling you, this guy's really smart. And that's something that certainly held up to be true. He is a very intelligent guy. And so what that allows him to do is learn, adjust, and improve. And I think, you know, it's allowed us to give him a bigger role and allowed him to do a lot of point guard type things at times, because he can learn so quickly and pick things up so quickly. So that's something that, you know, I think most people that watch him are astounded with his athletic ability combined with his size, which is amazing. But I think his intelligence will take him even further than his athletic ability will.
Well, talk about that, because you mentioned him, you know, doing some point guard duties, and over the last month and leading into the All-Star break, you were putting the ball in his hands more. And letting the offense sort of flow through him at the start, as opposed to, you know, maybe him doing his work down in the paint. Is that something that you've been able to get enough of a feel for in terms of the results that we're going to see more of that in the second half?
I'd like to do more and more and more of that, Jason, as we go on the rest of this year and into next year and into the future. I mean, this guy's got the ability to do that. The challenge for him to be able to do more of it, and he's aware of this, and it's not an easy thing for a guy of his size, is to get to elite level conditioning. Because if you're going to be the guy pushing the ball up the floor on every possession, it takes a whole nother level of conditioning that's not easy for a guy his size. So I would say he's in good shape, but not good enough to be the lead guy on every possession. So basically what we've been doing is, you know, after a free throw, after a dead ball, he brings the ball up the floor. And in other situations, all the other situations, Alonzo Ball or Eric Bledsoe, one of our young guards is bringing the ball up the floor and he's playing off the ball. So we would like to do as much of it as he can possibly handle, because I think that's where his greatness really lies. Yes, he can post up and do that also, but I think where his real greatness is as a primary ball handler initiating offense.
Stan, not to go stat geek crazy, because I'm an eyeball guy, and I'm sure to some degree you probably are, because you come from an older school of sports mentality, and I'm not even just talking about basketball. You know baseball pretty well and stuff like that. But I mean, the guy's made more layups than anyone in the league this year, and it's not even close. I mean, you know, he's near the top of the league in dunks. So it just shows you the ease with which he's getting to the basket. And he's putting on, and I don't use this term lightly, I'm not prone to hyperbole, I'm really not, but he is putting up Shaq-like dominance in the paint. And he's big, but he's not the super-sized figure that Shaq was in the paint. There's no other way to say it. And he shoots his free throws a little better than Shaq, too, at around 70%. You probably wish that was a little higher. I mean, he's 20. Am I crazy to say that we're just scratching the surface? That there's going to be a little bit of improvement potentially. We could be talking a once-in-a-generation type player here. Am I overstating it?
He certainly got that potential. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the sky's the limit for him. I think, you know, his free throw shooting up until the last game he played before the break against Chicago, where he went 8-for-16 at the line. Until then, he'd had a stretch of, I don't know, 15, 16 games where he was shooting about 80% at the free throw line. He's had huge improvement there. I think he will be win. I don't know if it'll be next year, year after, but some point here, he's going to be at least a league average 3-point shooter. He's got ball handling and passing skills. The sky's the limit. I can see him being, heck, he's already close, but he could be the best offensive player in the NBA. I mean, he's got that kind of potential. He's got two major challenges, and he knows both of these. One, like I said, is that elite level conditioning, which allows him to be a full-time primary ball handler. And his defense, because, you know, he has to play out on the floor defensively. He's much more comfortable defensively playing around the basket, but he's only 6'6", and so he needs to play out on the floor. And he's a big guy, you know, he's a big body to have to defend in today's NBA out on the floor. And so he's got a long way to go there too. But offensively, I mean, yeah, I just, there's no limit on how good he can be.
Now, are those paint numbers also a product of a league that is largely moved? I was laughing today. Andrew Yang, who you obviously know, Andrew Yang today tweeted out that the three-point shot is the new dunk in the NBA. That was the tweet he put out earlier tonight. He said that's not a good thing if that's the case. But are those numbers that we're seeing, those paint numbers for Zion, are those a product? How much of that is a product of the game moving so far outside, that the bigs have even moved so far outside? I know you've been putting the ball in his hands, like we were talking about, and with a team that's sixth youngest in the league, basically averaging 25 years old, how much of that is a product of the game moving beyond the three-point line for so many players, and him just being left to sort of run around untethered down in the paint?
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure that we've hit the limit on being able to help him either. I mean, you know, we play him with another traditional big most of the time. We've gotten a lot better over the last 20 games, but we haven't been, over the course of the year, a great three-point shooting team that creates space for him. And as you said, we're really young, and those numbers are, even saying we're the sixth youngest is a little bit deceptive.
It's skewed. It's skewed because of JJ and Steven Adams.
Yeah,
and Bledsoe.
I was going to say, and Atlanta's the only other team in the league whose three leading scorers are 23 or younger. And, you know, ourselves, Atlanta, and OKC are the only teams that are getting over 60% of their scoring from guys 23 or younger. So, we're really one of the two or three youngest teams in the league. And so he doesn't have a lot of experience around him. He hasn't had a plethora of three-point shooting around him. So I think not only does he have great room for improvement, so does the team that we put around him have great room for improvement. I think we can help him more than we are right now. I just think with he and Brandon Ingram, I mean, we've got a great foundation, and the results haven't been great yet, but I think the future and the potential we have is outstanding.
Your GM David Griffin recently, I was reading some quotes from him going throughout this season, and he likes to reference the youth on this team when discussing its shortcomings. He called the team's defense an abomination. How difficult is it to get young guys in this league to play on the defensive end? And is it getting harder to get that buy-in in such an offensive-minded era?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of buy-in. I think our guys buy in. I really do. I think it's, you know, they just don't have the basketball experience, and they haven't formed the habits that make you good defensively. It's been an area of disappointment for me this year. I thought coming in, Jason, that I could help them more defensively than I've been able to. So that's been a source of frustration for me as a coach, but it's not with our guys, a lack of buy-in. I see it every day. They're trying to buy in. I just really think it's, you know, they've got to form the habits. I don't think that the the lack of practice time has helped, because to me, those habits are formed through repetition, 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 and we're not getting that level of repetition. You know, it was interesting. We only had a little over 2 weeks in training camp, but the fact that we were in there every day repeating, we came out of the gate struggling offensively, but playing really well defensively. And as time's gone on, it's just totally shifted to where we've been a very good offensive team and a very bad defensive team. So I know from the beginning of the year that it's in us to be good defensively, that we simply need to, you know, get that level of repetition. And I haven't figured out how to get that or how to build those habits in the absence of practice repetition.
Stan Van Gundy's New Orleans Pelicans, they have played exactly 36 games, I believe, thus far this year, 15 and 21. They're 12th in the Western Conference standings overall. What can you do? You talk about the lack of practice time. Your GM's talked about it. What can you do and what are you doing to substitute? I know there's no substitute for practice. Channel my Allen Iverson. Practice. What else can you do to substitute for that lack of practice time? Your GM says more urgency. But that's an intangible. It's a word, but it's you know, people can't see urgency. What can you do to substitute for lack of practice time?
Well, I think that, you know, what you have to do is be really good in the time that you have. Good from our standpoint as coaches, in our teaching and the clarity of what we want and expect, and really good on the players' part in terms of an attention to detail and a focus. I think our walkthroughs on game days, we can be a little bit more locked into what's going on. And for us, we've got to find a way to balance work and rest a little bit better, to where, you know, we can at least get a little bit of work in on a daily basis and start building those habits. And the second half of the year is going to be even busier than the first half was. We played 36 games in 67 days. You know, so there's not going to be a ton of quality practice time. So you're going to have to find ways to get 5 minutes in, 10 minutes in a walkthrough of something that adds value to your team. And it's not an easy thing, but it's something that we've got to find some answers to.
Stan, I remember talking to you about, might've been 3 years ago, might have been even 4 years ago. And you were coaching the Pistons. Might've been your second season there. I can't remember, but I remember asking you about the Pistons situation and coaching there. And at the time you had said, this is going to be my last coaching job. What changed? What changed?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's something my wife and I ask each other almost every day, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I got away from it. I think the broadcasting that I did, you know, brought me to games on a regular basis. And especially when we got into the bubble last summer and I was there on a daily basis watching games, doing games, you know, there was just that itch to get back at it if the situation was right. And, you know, there weren't many where the situation would be good, but the young talent here, David Griffin and Trajan Langdon's record of success in building teams, an ownership group that also owns the Saints and has proven that they can have sustained success in professional sports. And then a city that we wanted to live in, you know, I mean, we've been to New Orleans several times. We love the city. It's a really unique city. There's no place like it in this country. And so it's sort of fulfilled everything that we would be looking for if we were to take one more run at it. And that's why we're here in New Orleans.
Nothing is this simple. So this is going to sound a tad bit simplistic. But if not for you being in the bubble, because I remember talking to you before the bubble, and you weren't sure if you were going to be in there. I remember we had a text exchange, and you weren't sure that you were actually going to be in there as a member of the media. if you're not in the bubble, are you the head coach of the Pelicans today?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. And for two reasons, I would say, you know, probably not. I'm not sure that I would have felt the same draw to come back. And I'm not sure I would have had the visibility that would have made me a candidate when there's so many good coaches out there. So I don't know for sure, but I would say that probably I would not be.
I agree with you. I don't think you're in there. I thought the second I heard you were in the bubble last year, I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, he's going to come out of this and wind up being a head coach. I absolutely felt it in my bones. When you wound up in the bubble, I had a feeling you were going to wind up being inside. When you got into the bubble, I had a feeling you were going to wind up with another head coaching job. We're talking with Stan Van Gundy, the head coach of the New Orleans Pelicans here on the Intersection podcast. Do you get a pass this year no matter what to some degree because of COVID? Does everybody kind of get a pass to some degree? Do we have to almost grade you on a curve and grade this team on a curve? I know everybody's playing with the same conditions, but you got a younger team. Do you almost have to, even as a coach, do you have to grade your players on a curve?
No, not really. I don't think so, and I don't think I deserve to be graded on a curve. I don't think we've played as well as we should be expected to play, particularly on the defensive end of the floor. So I don't have a problem being accountable to that. I mean, that's what it's a results-oriented business. I do think it shouldn't diminish anybody's hopes for the potential of this team. I mean, the talent is there. We've played really, really well at times. The offense has been good. It's Zion's first full year. We're playing with a lot of young guys. I mean, there should be and should remain great excitement here. You know, it's just a truism in this sport. If you're going to play that many young guys, your results just aren't going to be that good. I mean, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, and so I don't think anybody should be down on this team, but if they want to be down on me, that's fine. I mean, you know, and I'll take that accountability. Like I said, particularly defensively, Jason. So it's not a matter of grading on a curve. I just think when you look at our team, you have to go back and say, okay, let's go back in the history of teams whose three leading scorers are 23 and younger and see how they've done. First of all, you're not going to find many examples. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And so the excitement here should never diminish, you know, but at the same time, I certainly feel a responsibility that we need to play better.
We mentioned the All-Star game at the top with Zion, and he actually got a chance to start because of Ben Simmons, and Ben Simmons couldn't play because of the COVID scare and all this. Were you okay if you had it your way, if you're the grand poobah of the NBA, are you playing this All-Star game, or were you one of the people that was in the camp of not wanting it?
You know, here's the thing. I mean, I think that, you know, the easy answer is that it would have been a lot safer not to play it. But here's the thing. It would have been a lot safer probably not to play this season, right? I mean, the bottom line is we're playing this, all of us. I don't care. Anybody who's participating, the league office, players, coaches, we're doing this all for the same reason, right? Money. And the All-Star game is just an extension of that. It's more money in everybody's pocket. So I think it's disingenuous to say that, you know, we're all so concerned about safety that the game shouldn't be played. I mean, we're not that concerned about safety, or we wouldn't be doing what we're doing now. We're trying to take the precautions we can, but everybody, owners, everybody right down the line wants the money that's involved. And the All-Star game's part of that. So it's just an extension of everything else we've done. And I'm certainly not going to criticize the league office for that. Now, the one thing I will criticize the league office and other people who say this with is when you say, you know, safety's our number one concern. No, it's your number two concern. Your number one concern is making money. And your number two concern is, while we're making the money, let's keep everybody as safe as we can. So just let's just be honest about that. And again, that's not Adam Silver's choice. That's not the NBA owner's choice. They need all of us. They need the players and the coaches and the referees and everybody else. And we all have signed up for it and said, yep, we want the money too. So we're willing to take what we hope is a minimal risk.
I think it's great, though, that you have a younger team. And as we mentioned, the numbers even skewed the 25-year average age because you got a few older guys on that team that kind of skew it up to 25. I think it's amazing that you haven't had more issue because you think with younger guys, there's a maturity issue, whether we all like to admit it or not. Everybody always likes to, oh, so this so-and-so, they act older than their age. They're still kids. I mean, they're kids. Yeah. And being put into an impossible situation in terms of having to restrict their circles, monitor themselves. You know, I mean, from that perspective, it's got to be kind of impressive.
Yeah, no, it has been. Our guys have been fantastic. Aaron Nelson, who is, you know, heads up our medical and performance team. He's been great. Our doctor, Andrew Gottschalk, I mean, really staying in players' ears, educating them, helping them. And, I mean, all of us, I think, in the league recognize how hard this has been on everybody. You know, they don't get any release, you know, like, you know, normally you fly into a city and, you know, those guys like to go out to a nice dinner.
Yeah, let loose.
Either together or even the guys who don't let loose, just to go to a nice dinner or meet a friend in another city. You can't do any of that. I mean, you're basically locked in your hotel room. I mean, it's a hard thing, and especially when you're in a public high-pressure profession like those guys are in and you're young and everything else. So I have great admiration, not only for our players, but for all the players in the league and what they're going through. And then there's, look, you know, the thing nobody ever wants to talk about in any endeavor, but especially sports, is, you know, there's a huge luck factor too. So our guys have been great, but there's also luck. I mean, you can pass somebody by on the street who sneezes and boom, you get COVID.
Yeah.
So you can be being as responsible as you want. I'm sure there have been thousands and thousands of cases of very responsible people taking every precaution who have gotten COVID. So, you know, there's taking the precautions, there's being responsible, and then there's luck. And we've had all of that.
Can I compare you to one other team for a second? And I do it in a way of praise, and that's Phoenix. I look at, you know, Phoenix with a lot of that young talent, and now this year they add Chris Paul, who, by the way, I don't care what the statistics say, he's an MVP to me, because you look at what that team was with virtually the same roster, you add Chris Paul to the mix, and all of a sudden they're the second seed in the West. Are the Pelicans, because we got the trade deadline coming up, are the Pelicans a Chris Paul type player away, or are you simply time away? Are you simply a year or two just with this same group of players, your own big three with Lonzo, Brandon and Zion? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think it could be either, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of possibilities there. I mean, it's either add experience to the young guys or the young guys get experience. You know, obviously one maybe takes a little longer than the other. But I mean, we're considerably younger than, say, Phoenix. Like, I was just looking at this the other day. Phoenix has had their guys 23 and younger have scored a little over 500 points this year. Our guys 23 and younger have scored over 2,600 points. I mean, you know, they've gotten 13% of their offense from guys that young. We've gotten 64% of our offense from guys that young. I mean, I don't say that as an excuse. I say that as optimism for this team and organization going forward. But as you mentioned with Phoenix, I mean, you know, there is an experience factor there. I mean, all you've got to do is look at all the teams and where they are in the standings, and then look at who they're playing. I mean, you know, Milwaukee doesn't have a single guy in their rotation that young. Utah, who's the number one team in the league, doesn't have anybody 23 or younger anywhere in their rotation. You know, the Lakers and the Clippers have each have one guy 23 or younger. I mean, this is the way the league goes. And so, you know, when you say our guys have to get older, there's no way to speed that up.
Like, no.
you get older day by day. We all know that. Certainly I know that as an old dude, as you pointed out. But you can't speed it up. I can't take Zion from 20 to 23 by next year. I can't take Brandon Ingram from 23 to 28 by next year. And so
would your preference,
yeah,
though, but Stan?
It'll come in time. It will.
But Stan,
I like this team. And that doesn't mean we can't win now. Like I said, I've got to, our coaching staff has to, and our players have to, we have to figure out with these circumstances, how do we get better defensively? That's the question for us right now. And it's really, you know, probably 90% of the solution to winning more games.
But Stan, would you prefer to stay young? I mean, I'm not asking you to sit here and play GM, but I mean, would you prefer the route of patience? I mean, I'm not going to get into individual players. We know who's being rumored to be traded. I mean, would you prefer to stand pat and ride with this? Or if the right deal's out there, are you willing to part with one of these young pieces?
Look, I mean, and I'm not trying to evade the question, but, you know, I really, you know, I had my run at doing the front office thing in Detroit. And one of the things that I knew for sure is that I didn't want to go that route again. You know, I wanted to get with a GM, you know, with a vice president, that I really, really trusted. And that's where I am. And I trust David Griffin and Trajan Langdon to make, those decisions, and I'll go with whatever, they go with. I'm excited about this team. And my only focus is how do I make this team better on a daily basis? What do we do in Wednesday's practice to start making us better, particularly at the defensive end of the floor? How do we grow this team? And if Griff and Trajan decide to go in a different direction, then what do I do to make that team better? That's my focus. So I honestly, Jason, don't spend any time thinking about we should do this or we should do that or we need this guy or we need that guy. I literally don't waste a second doing that.
Along with Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr, you're one of the most, my best way I could describe it is vocal coaches, not just in the NBA, but in all sports when it comes to social and political issues. Was that ever something you had to address with Pelicans ownership before you were hired, or was it just, hey, that's what you come with?
No, I mean, they talked about it a little bit, you know, but so it's a little bit of both. I mean, you know, I had people when I was, you know, this summer starting to interview saying, you know, like, hey, all that speaking out, all that stuff that you talk about, all the stuff you put on Twitter, you know, could cost you a chance to coach. And that never really entered my mind. Now, I'm lucky enough that I didn't have to coach, you know, financially or anything else. And so when I have things I feel like I want to comment on, I'm going to comment on it. And you know, I they've been good about it here. Nobody's tried to silence me. They have talked to me a little bit about the more blatantly partisan stuff, which I think they made some really good points there, you know, to basically stick to the issues. And I've tried to do that. Haven't always stuck just to the issues, but I've tried hard to stick to the issues that I care about. And so I actually think some of ownership and front office guidance on that issue has been good, hasn't limited me, and probably in a lot of ways has made me more effective.
I think one of the things I love about you is that you are unapologetically you, though. And from the moment I met you, you've been that way. I'm a lot the same way. I'm unapologetically me. I say what I'm going to say. I tweet what I'm going to tweet, and be damned the consequences of doing that. But I love the fact that you are still willing. I mean, I was just going through your Twitter feed a little bit before I had you on, and I just love the fact that you put it out there, whereas so many people would just rather kind of sit in the background and not say anything. You use your voice of prominence to try and make a difference. And I think that's admirable. Whether people agree or disagree with your political point of view or stances on social causes, I think there's a respect that has to be had for the fact that you're willing to put yourself out there. Because unlike Kerr and Popovich, you don't need me to tell you this, they got 8 combined world championships. They could fart into the microphone when they walk into their next press conference, and they're not getting fired. You are not a guy that's won 8 championships. Yeah, you got a good record as a head coach, but you haven't won 8 championships. So the reality is you have a lot more at stake professionally than those guys because they're not getting fired no matter what they say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, though, because, the guys who have a lot at stake are the guys who are not financially secure and, they need the jobs. I don't. So in that way, it doesn't take a lot of courage or anything to speak out. And look, the stuff that I'm mainly speaking out on, I know people do oppose some of these things, but I don't understand how, because basically what I'm speaking out about is equality, racial equality, gender equality, LGBTQ equality, income equality, fairness to workers. I mean, it those things shouldn't be, at least, right, Jason, shouldn't be partisan issues. Like, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, how do you oppose those things? Voting rights. Everybody shouldn't have the right to vote. We shouldn't make it as accessible as possible. I don't get that. Like, I get it politically that it may benefit some people to suppress some people's vote, but I don't get how you can be upset at me or anyone else for having an attitude that we think voting should be accessible to everybody, or that, the Equality Act should pass, or the Equal Rights Amendment should be ratified, any of these things. I mean, these seem like no-brainers to me, and the fact that they're not is probably the most disappointing thing about the entire American political scene, is that we're arguing over things that should be givens.
It's broken. The political system's broken, Stan. I'll actually take you to task on something. I'll challenge you for a second on something you tweeted. You were having a little back and forth with someone on what players say versus what they do when it comes to helping those less fortunate. And one of these trolls was out there, and they kind of hit you with it. And you said, this is the exact quote you said, "Saying we don't do anything is ignorant." Totally agree, by the way. "You have no idea what we do. Second, charity will never be able to take the place of a more compassionate public policy. We can have capitalism and still take care of people's basic needs. Many countries do. We don't seem to want to." And that's what you tweeted. And I agree with 80% of that tweet. The 20% I don't agree with is this. I think capitalism's broken. I think it's broken. And I'm not sure it can be fixed when so much of fixing it is tied to getting agreement that it's broken in the first place, and then needing buy-in from those that may not have the urgency to fix it because of how it may impact their bottom line. You see what I'm getting at there?
Well, I do, but the fact that people won't buy into it doesn't mean it's not possible. I mean, we've got a lot of examples, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, that are certainly capitalistic, but have a base, provide everybody with a
social contract. There's a social contract.
Yeah, a social contract, a real safety net, to where we'll provide all of our people with an opportunity to live, have a place to live and be able to eat, and medical care and education. But now beyond that, they're totally capitalistic. I mean, they're not a socialistic country. None of them are, by any means. And so That's what I mean by a possibility. Now, is it a possibility that we can do that? I might agree with you on that. There's so many people fighting against it that are in positions of power that it's hard to see it being a possibility here. But that doesn't mean it's not possible. That just means we're not willing as a country to do it. We have too many people who stand against it. But we have countries out there proving that it can be done, that all of those things can be done. But we just don't have the will right now as a country to do it. And I find that sad because we have the resources to do it. And the fact that with all those resources, we won't do it is an indictment of us as a country.
Last year, it was George Floyd. It was racial injustice and inequities, as we talked about, that galvanized players. And then that sort of melded into and fed itself into the election and helping voting rights and trying to get more people to the polls. And no matter who you vote for, it was, hey, get out and vote, get out the vote, that sort of thing. Even though I think we know most NBA players lean left, with it being a league largely dominated by minorities. This year, with the election now behind us, is it a different mentality in terms of guys being engaged in the social and political issues, at least as it relates to your team?
Well, we're younger, so, you know, the guys that are more engaged, like a J.J. Redick, tend to be a little older, just a little bit. You're right, the election's not there, but you see LeBron and his group very engaged right now to combat the voter suppression bills that are being introduced in 43 states here in the country. So they're still engaged. I think one of the reasons the engagement is down is we can't gather. So one of the things I know working with the Coaches Association last year, when they went into the bubble, one of the things that everybody was sort of charged with doing was to work with grassroots groups in your community on the ground, you know, engaging on issues of social justice, policing, things like that. Well, you can't. You can't engage with anybody. You can't meet with anybody. We can't go to events. And so I think when things open back up, regardless of where we are in the election calendar, I think you'll see NBA players and NBA coaches out there fully engaged in what's going on, using their platforms and everything else. And I think guys are still doing it. Like I said, with LeBron and then Chris Paul, I mean, we talked about the All-Star game. He turned that into a lot of support for historically black colleges and universities, you know, the HBCUs. So, you know, that's an issue near and dear to his heart. And yeah, these guys are engaged. And I would say, I will put NBA players and maybe even more so WNBA players up against people their ages in terms of activism and engagement anywhere in the country. I mean, I look at them in amazement sometimes because I think back to when I was in my 20s and all I cared about was moving my career ahead. I mean, I was informed. I was somebody who's always stayed informed, but engaged in trying to create change, not even in the least. It was just, how do I get the next win, the next job, the next recruit, and move through my career? And to see these guys who could very well just separate, take their money, live their nice, comfortable lives, and, you know, keep all their fans happy and not get engaged, to instead make the choice to be engaged and to speak for people that don't have the outreach that they have. It's inspiring to me. I have tremendous respect for the players in our league on a lot of levels, but certainly on that level.
I'm rooting for you, buddy. I really am. I hope this Pelicans team can turn it around this season. The West is just so tough. I'm rooting for you to see if you can get this thing turned around this season. If not this year, then obviously over the next couple of years with such a young roster. Go Tigers, by the way. I love Willie Castro. I know you're not going to get to watch a lot of baseball here early on in the year, but I'm a big Willie Castro guy. That guy is – nobody was talking about him, and he was putting up decent numbers in the short time last year. That kid can play. I know you're a Tigers guy. That Willie Castro is going to be something special.
Yeah, I mean, my son is still up in that area and following him, and he really wants to see Torkelson and, you know, Riley Green. I don't know if Riley Green won't be up this year, but he's a guy from Central Florida in the same school district all my kids went to, who's a great young talent. And then the Tigers have a lot of great young pitching coming up, too. So they've had to wait a long time there, but I think they've got it headed in the right direction. I'll just be happy when I can get to a Major League Baseball game safely. You know, hopefully that'll be this summer.
Yeah, I think it will. Stan, best of luck, my friend. It seems like once a year we get to have these conversations, and honestly, I cherish them. They're one of my favorite things I get to do every year. So thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Have a good one.
And thanks again to Pelicans head coach Stan Van Gundy. Always a good conversation. And thanks to you for checking out the latest episode of the Intersection Podcast. Make sure to subscribe and never miss an episode. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And while you're at it, check out the Up Late with Jason Page podcast. That's right. You can watch the show weeknights at 11 p.m. Eastern on all your favorite social media platforms, or just grab the podcast each Tuesday through Saturday morning. I'm Jason Page. Till next time, stay grounded, and thanks for joining me inside the Intersection Podcast from Believe.